ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, I'm Kylie Morris, and this is the Radio National Hour, coming to you from the land of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation in Sydney. Coming up, the government has revealed its plan for artificial intelligence to develop the data centres, upskill and protect workers, and keep us safe from harm. But will this strategy help us take advantage of this technological behemoth? Or is it a missed opportunity? An expert panel is standing by. Also ahead, he once boasted he would stuff cocaine right up the noses of the gringos. But the former Honduran president, convicted and sentenced to 45 years for drug trafficking, could soon walk out of his Manhattan jail cell with a pardon from Donald Trump, the same US president who's currently pursuing Venezuela's leader over his alleged involvement in drug trafficking. Don't worry, you're not the only one with whiplash. And an invitation to ponder Australia's long and complicated history with acclaimed writer and playwright Tom Keneally.
Generally, if it'll make trouble, I'm willing to give a chat on it.
He may be 90, but Tom Keneally is still making good trouble. Get a dose of it yourself later in the show. Just before we start this next interview, I should warn you that it was written entirely by human beings. The federal government has today released its National Artificial Intelligence Plan, detailing how it will harness the benefits of AI, ensuring they're spread across the economy and public sector, all while keeping us safe. It's an extensive plan, but there's already concern over one missing element. Critically, it falls in line with demands from the business sector to do away with a proposal for mandatory guardrails, instead creating an AI Safety Institute to provide advice on gaps in existing laws. For more on what the government is attempting with this plan, I'm joined by Dr. Sue Kay, who's the director of the AI Institute at the University of New South Wales, and by Simon Chris, who's co-founder and CEO of Sovereign Australia AI. Sue and Simon, welcome both of you to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you so much.
Thanks.
I'm interested in each of your immediate reactions to this plan released today. Sue, you first. There's been a long wait, of course, to get this far. Does the plan do what it needs to do?
Well, the plan has all the right words, but it actually doesn't seem to appear to have anything to back that up. So there are no announcements of new funding or really new initiatives to help to see these actions come alive. And for the period of time that we've been waiting for this plan to come about, that's a bit disappointing because it feels like it hasn't really been thought through how to do more than just actually develop a plan. How to implement that plan seems to be what's missing.
You've expressed concern, I know, too, Sue, that there's no firm commitment to update Australia's compute capacity. Tell me firstly what that is and what the impact of that is.
So for AI research, whether that or development of AI models, whether that be in industry or academia, you need to be able to access high-powered computing, you know, in the form of what we call graphical processing units or GPUs. In Australia, we haven't upgraded our supercomputing facilities here since 2018, and most other countries started developing their AI strategies at about that time and have invested billions of dollars accordingly to upgrade their computing capacity so that AI models and algorithms could be being built and being deployed. In Australia, we just haven't seen that investment come about. And what that means is that we are starting to lose our AI talent, because if you are an AI specialist, then you really need to be somewhere where you're able to develop those models and algorithms on you know, this computing infrastructure, which we are, you know, quite conspicuously not investing in. In fact, when we look to recruit talent in AI, one of the first questions that we're asked is how many GPUs do I get access to? So this is a real problem for us because there is a global war for talent. And even if we are not committed to creating our own AI, we need people who understand how these models are being built and the impact that they're likely to have on our economy and also on our society. And that is something that is desperately required but not found in this document.
So, Simon, if we are already, as Sue says, losing this global war for talent, what do you make of the government's plan? Does it do enough? Is it clear enough on what the next steps should be? Is there meat on the bones of this?
Yeah, look, I would agree with Sue. I think it's a great start. Is it where we need to be and is it fully fleshed out enough? Probably not quite, and I'm hoping that happens over time. I think the race for talent, as Sue rightly says, is also linked to compute power. People want to work on exciting new projects and they can't do that if we don't have enough compute power. At Sovereign Australia AI, actually, we're having to invest more than $30 million ourselves just to get compute to do the job that we need to do. And there should be a more countrywide push around that sort of stuff. The other concern I have with the plan, of course, is the idea of an AI safety institute. And if we're dealing with offshore models and offshore providers of AI, if we just become a net buyer of AI, how is that institute going to have any teeth? How is it going to influence a behemoth like OpenAI to change something?
Sue, what do you think? Does Simon have a point there that this AI Safety Institute may well not be fit for purpose, may well not have the teeth required to do what it sets out to do?
Well, I think it is very important that we have a safety institute, but I completely agree with Simon that if we as a country are not developing our own AI, that makes us puts us very much at risk of undue influence from other countries and indeed being completely reliant on those countries, in which case we might make decisions about what we do find acceptable or unacceptable in terms of AI use, but have very little ability to do anything about it. Because at the moment, the action plan suggests that it is positioning Australia to have a world-class AI ecosystem, but the details don't seem to back that up.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. I'm Kylie Morris and I'm speaking with Dr. Sue Kay, who's the director of the AI Institute at the University of New South Wales, and Simon Chris, who's CEO of Sovereign Australia AI, about the government's newly released National Artificial Intelligence Plan. Simon, business had taken issue with the mandatory guardrails that were proposed by the previous minister, Ed Husic. Why didn't they like these?
I don't think business ever likes anything mandatory from the government. But when you look at what happened in the EU with their EU AI Act, it did stifle innovation to the point where the EU is now rolling back on some of its previous things. And so I think Australian businesses just looked at them and thought that they were going to be very difficult to implement and could stifle innovation. I think the approach of not having overarching legislation is probably the right one.
Just to inject a bit more context there, Simon, so the Productivity Commission had wanted a hold until an audit of gaps in the law could be carried out. So the theory was, you know, there's a concern that existing regulation isn't enough to deal with threats by AI to, for example, privacy rights, to consumer protection, to copyright. But the government is now saying, look, existing laws are enough and any specific harms can be managed by this $30 million AI Safety Institute. Sue, does that feel like a reasonable compromise to you?
Yeah, I think it is. I'm not a legal scholar, but my background is a bit more in robotics or what some people describe as physical AI. And a lot of the guardrails are already in place where physical AI is concerned and well covered by our existing workplace health and safety laws, our privacy regulations. So, you know, you can't deploy robots in a workplace in an unsafe manner. I think we can probably learn a lot from that example. And, you know, I think it is a tricky area because it is pushing the boundaries of many of our existing pieces of legislation. But I think in general, you know, until it becomes clear that we need additional guardrails, we should be looking at how we can deploy the ones that we already have.
So the Greens have accused the government of putting the interests of big business ahead of the mental health of Australians with this plan, quote, opening the floodgates to unregulated AI agents. I think the word Senator David Shoebridge used to describe it was cooked. Simon, I'm sure you don't share his view, but there would be a lot of parents out there, for example, and people who've already found themselves ensnared by AI who share this concern. Do you think those people who are fearful of AI playing suddenly too much of a role of our lives without appropriate regulation or even understanding will be satisfied with this plan?
Look, I don't think they will be satisfied, but I think there is a lot of scaremongering around what AI can do, what it can't do. AI itself is not a, you know, a terrible technology in the same way that social media itself wasn't a terrible technology. What it came down to was how did humans use it? And this will be the same with AI. If people want to use AI for nefarious purposes or just use it in a way in which it's not designed, then you're going to get that kind of harm. But if people are made aware of when to trust AI, when not to trust AI, what to use it for, what not to use it for, I think that's going to quell quite a lot of that fear.
Sue, is there enough in this plan to offer some reassurance, build some trust on the part of, you know, the AI future we face?
Well, I don't think it's articulated in the plan, but our eSafety Commissioner, you know, is not just looking at social media, and my understanding is that they're looking at some of the areas of AI adoption that I think we all definitely should be concerned about, such as the reliance on AI companions, whether those should be accessible to children in any way, shape or form. And yeah, my understanding is that this is something the eSafety Commissioner is looking into. So I think the problem, you know, with any new technology is that a bit like cybersecurity, you know, just as you manage to find a way to prevent harm coming from one direction, people come up with new ways that might cause harm. And so it is always going to be a matter of, you know, having a look at what these new threats are and how what the best response is to try and mitigate those harms. And, you know, I guess back to, you know, some of the detail in the plan, you know, I think we probably spend about $1 billion a year in cybersecurity to help protect our businesses and you know, keep our economy safe. And, you know, although there is a lot of talk about how we're going to support and train Australians and support businesses, again, we're not seeing a commitment for funding to make that happen.
Simon, another area of concern is sustainability. I mean, under new environment laws now in Australia, new data centre approvals can be fast-tracked if they're co-located with new renewable power. But does that counterbalance the massive demands of data centres, I'm wondering, not only for energy but for water? I mean, this plan seems largely silent on these really important questions about resources, sharing resources like water.
Yeah, once again, I don't agree that the drain on resources is as high as people think it is. Just 2 days ago, Mandela put out a brand new report about data centres in Australia, sharing that they only consume 2% of Australia's electricity, very much aligned to what shopping centres across Australia consume. And similarly from water, the little amount of water that they use is 7 times less than what we use in our public swimming pools across Australia.
Dr. Sue Kay, Director of the AI Institute at the University of New South Wales, and Simon Chris, CEO of Sovereign Australia AI, are with me on the Radio National Hour. Simon, there's a recognition that there needs to be greater emphasis on digital skills and access. So there is a capability gap here. It's not all about technology itself. Is that something you recognise, and does the plan explain how Australia overcomes that?
It is something that I recognise, and the plan unfortunately doesn't go far enough in that area. They do talk about some $460 million for training and development and bits and pieces, but without being specific about where that will happen and how that will happen, the Department of Finance recently said that they want to roll out mandatory AI training for all government workers. Well, what about rolling out something similar for all corporate workers? We need to have just greater AI literacy in this country.
Sue, is it outmoded thinking to imagine that Australia needs all the elements for its own AI sector here? I'm just trying to understand, could Australia not specialise or contribute to the AI ecosystem in a partial way and enjoy the benefits of collaboration rather than owning the whole process? I guess I'm being very old-fashioned here and thinking about manufacturing, for example.
Yes, well, Australia can develop a whole range of, AI technologies, but, in terms of specialisation, I think we have a lot of great opportunities. And going back to your point around environmental sustainability, one thing that Australia is very good at is developing AI for resource-constrained environments. So, if we want to alleviate the environmental impact of data centres, then Australians are really in a very good position to be developing AI that can do exactly that. And certainly there's a lot of room for us to be developing our own domain-specific models. There are a lot of data sets here in Australia, particularly in the healthcare sector, that we don't want to be opening up to foreign interests and to commercial interests, that we really need to have the capabilities onshore to be able to get the value out of and make sure that we can deliver some of the benefits of artificial intelligence, such as personalised healthcare, precision medications, a whole range of things such as improved cancer diagnostics, which we can't do if we are not actually investing in developing AI and trying to get value out of, some of the fantastic data sets that we already possess.
You talk about investment there. I mean, it all sounds very expensive. Has the government committed the necessary funds to advance their ambitions for this plan, or at least to generate the necessary investment to cover it?
There's not actually any new money articulated in this action plan. And, with the Australian Academy of Technological Sciences and Engineering, we've demonstrated that Australia is investing one-tenth of what our peer nations of, similar size are investing in artificial intelligence. So, we're coming to the party quite late and we're still not prepared to invest a lot of money. And I guess it depends on what you consider a large amount of money. If we were to look at invest a similar amount that we invest in cybersecurity every year of about $1 billion, then that would go a long way towards making sure that we are uplifting AI capability in Australia and also helping to stem the loss of talent.
Simon, that's a worry, isn't it? Where should the money come from for all this? Should the government be investing or creating the conditions for private sector investment?
I think a little bit of both. I think it depends who's going to benefit from the infrastructure. If the groups that are going to benefit is the wider Australian public or our academic research and things like that, then the government should definitely be doing that. And they have some $15 billion earmarked in the NRF, and they could take some of that money. If the beneficiary of this is a private company that's out there going to be making a profit, then yes, of course, they should be paying for their own tools of the trade. So I think that it sits in a little bit of both, but definitively the government needs to be investing way more into AI than they are right now.
Sue, Simon, it sounds to me like there's so much work to come on this subject, but thanks for sharing your insights today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Dr. Sue Kay is director of the AI Institute at the University of New South Wales, and Simon Chris is the co-founder and CEO of Sovereign Australia AI. Now, coming up, a real treat, Australia's first Booker Prize winner, Thomas Keneally, joins me to talk about his latest recognition, a new oration named in his honour.
If you haven't heard, breakfast has a different sound in 2025. Every morning, expert ABC correspondents bring you the biggest stories, the best analysis, and the sharpest interviews. From politics to business, global affairs to sport, we cover what matters with depth, insight, and authority.
Breakfast, back tomorrow morning from 5:30 a.m. on ABC Radio National.
Even as the Trump government faces questions over its targeting of Venezuela's drug trade, the president has announced that he'll pardon a former leader of Honduras. In his 8 years as president, Juan Orlando Hernandez, or JOH as he's known, prevailed over a narco state. He's a Central American strongman whose rule was characterized by corruption and impunity, extrajudicial killings and bribes from cartels to buy favours. He was accused of receiving millions in bribes and partnering with cocaine traffickers, and was convicted last year in Manhattan and sentenced to 45 years in prison. But President Trump insists he was set up by the Biden administration.
The people of Honduras really thought he was set up, and it was a terrible thing. He was the president of the country. And they basically said he was a drug dealer because he was the president of the country. And they said it was a Biden administration setup. And I looked at the facts and I agreed with them.
What evidence would you share that he was set up and that he wasn't?
Well, you take a look. I mean, they could say that you take any country you want. If somebody sells drugs in that country, that doesn't mean you arrest the president and put him in jail for the rest of his life.
That's Donald Trump. Luis G. Moreno is a former U.S. ambassador and career member of the Foreign Service over many decades. He served as the Narcotics Affairs Director in Bogota, Colombia, and prior to that worked in narcotics enforcement in Panama and Peru. He's also a member of the Academy for American Diplomacy. Ambassador Moreno, welcome so much to the Radio National Hour.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here with you.
If you had to describe Juan Orlando Hernandez for us in simple terms, what kind of a president was he for Honduras?
He was a stereotypical bad guy, strong-armed, corrupt, violent, narcissistic schemer who got down in the trenches with some of the most violent things in that country. His brother had been investigated and convicted in 2019. I would add, under the first Trump administration, and the lead prosecutor in that case, ironically, is Emile Bove, who later went on to become Donald Trump's personal attorney and is now a sitting judge. He was the one who opened this can of worms. Look, I've been reading about Hernandez since way back before I resigned and retired from the Foreign Service. The intel reports on this guy were very complete. DEA had him on their radar forever when he was a congressman, when he was the head of the House of Representatives or the Congress, the Honduran Congress. This guy has been dirty for a long time. And one of the great quotes from his trial was he told people he wanted to shove cocaine up the nose of the gringos. He took $1 million in cash in a suitcase from El Chapo. Interestingly enough, he's also accused of having rigged his re-election campaign in 2017. And right now, as we speak, they're still counting the votes between his former party, which he has great interest in seeing win, and two opponents, one from the ruling liberal leftist party, another one from an anti-corruption crusader. And the leftist seems to have fallen off. It's now within 200 votes, with 57% of vote counted, between the anti-corruption guy and Hernandez's former party. all this has to do with politics. It has to do with corruption. It has to do with hypocrisy. And really, quite frankly, with what's going on in Venezuela, bipolar policy.
Ambassador, we'll come back to that question of the elections in Honduras in a moment, because you're right. I think it's relevant and fascinating. But we heard Donald Trump there attempting to explain this decision, asserting that Hernandez was stitched up by the Biden administration simply because he was the president of a country implicated in drug trafficking, which is interesting. But does that underplay the significant body of evidence that implicated Hernandez in these crimes?
The information and intelligence that was gathered by the Drug Enforcement Administration and by other U.S. government agencies was massive. I used to read it. Those intel reports read like an action novel about how bad this guy was. This guy was a really, really bad guy. He got in cahoots with his brother and with other corrupt people, including Chapo Guzman, and was personally supervising. He was well aware of the extrajudicial killings. This guy is a really, really bad guy. So for President Trump to sit there with a straight face and say that this is a Biden administration stitch-up, or whatever it was when it was his own administration, his own Department of Justice in 2019 that got the ball rolling when Hernandez's brother was arrested, I mean, I find it the height of unbelievability, really, to be honest.
How much work goes into building these kinds of cases? I mean, they're not just thrown together overnight, are they? I mean, this had to be a case that justified extraditing a former president from a neighbouring country, bringing them to the US. I mean, presumably that would not have been undertaken by the DOJ unless they felt like they really had all the evidence required.
Absolutely, absolutely. It had to be what we call a slam dunk. Years of DEA investigative work, which I would imagine would be Title III wiretaps. It would witnesses. It would entail being able to flip people that were under these people to turn state's evidence. It would entail the extradition part in of itself, a massive effort to get a former president of a country extradited, working with the State Department, working with the Department of Justice, working with the national security. I mean, it has to be a really massive effort. I'd love to speak to the DEA agents that did put all the work on this, put their lives on the line, put their informers' lives on the line to get this conviction and get the guy sentenced to 45 years. And, you know, this was in June, and a few months later, President Trump says he's going to throw it out the window. It's really the height of, it's very frustrating, and it's going to create a lot of resentment and problems.
I can hear your frustration there. I mean, you mentioned El Chapo, who, of course, is the notorious former leader of the Sinaloa cartel in Mexico. Correct. Hernandez was accused at trial of accepting bribes from El Chapo. $1 million in the jungle, I think, was the account of it that I read. I mean, what does this tell us about how deeply immersed Hernandez was in this world, and also, I guess, how vital that income was to his presidency?
Back in those days, and still to a great extent today, the major trafficking route for Colombian cocaine through Central America to the Mexican distributors and then into the United States. Not fast boats leaving the eastern or western coast of Venezuela and traveling, you know, in the direction of Trinidad and Jamaica and, you know, the western Caribbean, eastern Caribbean. It doesn't work that way. The major route was Central America to Mexico and to the U.S. And who controlled that? Who was the linchpin and the kingpin and the guy who controlled all that? It was Hernandez. He personally controlled that route. And that's why people like Chapo Guzman had to give him millions of dollars to keep that pipeline open. He's responsible, you know, at least 400 metric tons, they say, but it was much more than that over the years, much more than 400 metric tons. You know, this guy is like what we in the U.S. are now accusing Maduro of. This guy was Maduro on steroids. He was moving an incredible amount of cocaine into the United States.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour. I'm Kylie Morris, and I'm speaking with former US Ambassador Luis Moreno about President Donald Trump's announcement that he intends to pardon former Honduran President Juan Orlando Hernandez, who was convicted last year of conspiring to import cocaine into the United States and of serious weapons charges. He was sentenced to 45 years in prison. Luis, you touch on the timing of this, given the current campaign against alleged drug traffickers in Venezuela and that real surge in tension that we're seeing today between Venezuela and Washington. Can you make any sense of the president acting in this way toward the Maduro government and targeting cartels, apparently, and at the same time issuing a pardon for Hernandez?
It's bizarre. It's truly bipolar. It's totally incomprehensible in my mind as someone who spent so many years in counter-narcotics efforts. He's accusing Maduro of doing everything that Hernandez was doing. I mean, it is true. Maduro is an illegitimate president. He lost to Edmundo Gonzalez last year. He has no right to be. 7 million Venezuelans have left. The average Venezuelan has lost 24 pounds of actual body weight on the average because he's ruined the country's economy as well. And there is an informal cartel of sorts. I calling it a cartel is really kind of a little bit of a stretch, but sure, there's informal networking between generals and officers in Venezuelan armed forces that wear suns on their shoulders, right? That's the rank of general. That's why they call it the Cartel de los Soles. So it's a remarkable, unprecedented situation you have when you're going to pardon a guy who was just as bad, if not worse. I would maintain he was worse than what Maduro is doing.
I know there was a time when Hernandez, then president, was an ally to the US. I think in Donald Trump's first term, Hernandez agreed that Honduras could play a role to stop undocumented migrants traveling north to the US border. And is there any chance that Donald Trump's offer of a presidential pardon might be in recognition for past behavior?
I think he's more transactional as far as present and future things. I don't think he's the type of guy who pays debts, to be quite honest. Yes, I mean, he was very transactional in his dealings with Manuel López Obrador. He let López Obrador get away with murder as far as some of the things that were going on in regards to the NAFTA success and stuff, you know, the U.S.-Canada-Mexico trade agreement. He let López Obrador promote natural gas and oil drilling and all sorts of stuff they weren't supposed to do under the new accord in exchange for López Obrador cracking down on people coming to the border. I'm sure that that's why Trump has took the unusual and bizarre step of endorsing Hernandez's successor candidate for president of Honduras. He went on Truth Social media saying people of Honduras will vote for this guy and I will help them. And if not, I'm going to cut off all funding. Yes. And as part of that deal, I'm going to pardon Hernandez.
Does that make more sense than any other explanation for the announcement of this pardon that President Trump has publicly endorsed, as you say, you know, one of the two conservative candidates, which of course is unusual, but perhaps with such a narrow lead, there is a belief that, you know, a promise to pardon Hernandez might encourage voters to support that candidate?
Yes, of course, of course. I, like I said, Donald Trump is extremely transactional, and I think that's exactly what he's doing. And I think who knows what secret backdoor. You know, we have a thing that's going on that's really worrisome as far as I'm concerned. We don't have a process anymore. We used to have a process where the different agencies, State Department, the National Security Council, Department of Defense, all get together and have deputies meetings, principals meetings. They produce decision papers, decision memorandum, et cetera, et cetera. We don't do that. Trump doesn't get his intelligence briefings. He watches Fox News. And what we're doing foreign policy by tweets. He will tweet something about foreign affairs or foreign policy that he has not vetted or talked to the State Department or the or National Security Council. And then everyone reacts. And this is what he's doing. He's done it with Ukraine. He's done it with this Canadian stuff and with the Greenland stuff. And now he's doing it with Honduras. There always seems to be some kind of transaction that he's got behind his back that he's pushing his own agenda.
On the Radio National Hour, you're hearing from Luis G. Moreno, who's a former US ambassador with decades of experience, including in, I guess, we could call it narco diplomacy. Luis, what's your assessment of the current approach by the White House to Venezuela if it's about eradicating drug cartels? Is extrajudicial assassinations of suspected drug boats, closing the Venezuela airspace, are these kinds of steps that are being taken by President Trump a viable way to achieve that eradication of drug cartels if that's what he's aiming to do?
For my eye, no, absolutely not. Standard law enforcement would have you intercept and interdict these vessels, capture the crew, seize the drugs, and try to pressure the crew as to where they were going, who they were working for, where they were taking it, and then you move up the chain and you try to capture as many people. That's how you go to cartels. You intercept, interdict, interrogate, and then get people to turn over, to turn on their, you know, good plea deals or whatever you could. That's what we should be doing, by the way, with the Venezuelan high command is doing deals like that instead of doing what we're doing. This type of thing is not effective in stopping anything. You know, Colombian traffickers, if stuff that I used to read and used to comment on with the Colombian National Police and intelligence officers and other more, cartels have a built-in capacity to lose anywhere from 10 to 25% of their shipments and still have enough left to have tremendous amount of profitability in what they're running. In fact, many times cartels would leak information about a certain shipment of a few tons to distract law enforcement, have them go seize that, while meanwhile a much larger shipment was going on undetected. That's a very common. So hitting stray cigarette boats, fast boats, or whatever you want to call it, where they're not sure who's on them, where they're going, what they're doing, just simply blowing them up. No, that's not very effective at all. It's just the opposite in many respects.
Luis, if Juan Orlando Hernandez is released and he returns to Honduras, what are the chances he'd be pursued for drug offences at home?
I would doubt it if his part, well, it depends who wins, right? That's what it comes down to. This guy Nasrallah, the other guy, right-wing guy, who supposedly won Hernandez beat last election, where Nasrallah maintains it was rigged, as do a lot of people. If he wins, yeah, I think Hernandez could be in trouble. But if the other guy wins, the guy who Trump endorsed publicly, if he wins, Hernandez will be sitting pretty when he goes home.
And what message would it send to the region about how serious this White House is about its war on drugs?
It would destroy, as it is now, much of the credibility that the United States government has worked so hard over the previous decades about the seriousness and the importance on the so-called war on drugs by allowing this guy to go back. And, you know, if his compinche, as we say, is back in power, you know, I would have no doubt that he would get involved in bad stuff again and feel completely comfortable and untouchable back in Honduras.
Ambassador, thank you so much for joining me and for sharing your analysis.
Thank you. Thank you. I really appreciate it.
That's Luis G. Moreno, who's a former US ambassador and career member of the Foreign Service over many decades. Between 1997 and 2001, he served as the Narcotics Affairs Director in Bogota, Colombia, and prior to that worked in narcotics enforcement in Panama and Peru. You're listening to the Radio National Hour. Across more than 50 books, from The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith to the Booker Prize-winning Schindler's Ark, Thomas Keneally has spent a lifetime inviting Australians to see themselves more clearly. And now he's branching into a new form of story. The Manly Writers Festival has announced the creation of the Thomas Keneally Oration, an annual speech that will invite leading thinkers to wrestle with the big questions facing Australia. Fittingly, the first oration will be delivered next year by the man himself, opening the festival's third year and establishing a permanent home for his particular spirit of curiosity and humanity. And I'm pleased to say that Tom Keneally joins me now. Tom, welcome to the Radio National Hour.
Oh, thank you very much.
Now, you've long been someone who contributes to Australia's public conversation. Is that what you'd like this event to become, something of a conversation starter?
Yes, yes, indeed. I think there are a lot of great ideas out there that deserve more airing. For example, a friend of mine called Richard Dennis recently wrote a book on what a dismal thing the centre of politics is. He wrote a book called Dead Centre, in which he takes apart this idea that the centre must be satisfied. This rush to the centre is something that characterises politics now, and it's not necessarily the answer, because there's not always a centre there, and the centre is not always the right result. But anyhow, that sort of argument would be a good one for an oration, wouldn't it?
It would. And Tom, you're delivering the first one in March next year. Now, I don't know what you're like with deadlines, but are you already thinking about the kind of theme that you might focus on?
Yes, I in my old age, I've got quite a bit of a thing about Mungo Man and Mungo Lady. I'm trying to write a book on Mungo Man and Mungo Lady. These are 40,000, 42,000 year old humans. And the oldest ritual burials that we have of our species on this earth. And we pretend they don't exist. If the Egyptians had them, there'd already be three hotels built out where.
And a beautiful museum.
Yes, indeed. But we're still coming to terms with the fact that there were people here 42,000 years ago. And I think neither of these realities has quite clicked in with us in the public arena yet. So that's a sort of troublemaking argument that makes good orations. But when it comes to convicts, which is my favourite subject in Australian history, we've had some extraordinary convicts, and I don't think we're confronted who they were. We remember the names of British governors, but we don't remember the names of some of the convicts that spent time here. And I think we got away with a lot here in Australia from being distant. The punishment and the treatment of the Eureka rebels would have been had they been tried in the UK or in Ireland. But distance was also a liberator for us. And I don't think we've confronted that. And that'd be a good subject for a talk. So generally, if it'll make trouble, I'm willing to give a chat on it.
I mean, I guess good trouble is a way to give people a nudge, isn't it? You know, whether it be a deeper sense of empathy or even that kind of historical, you know, truths that perhaps we've been avoiding.
Yes, indeed. There's so many of our convicts were social bandits, for example. They were involved in protests over land. Even some of the poachers were politically minded poachers. And so quite a few of our convicts were quite good people. And I don't think we've confronted these men and women and given them their place in Australian history. We sort of got to the end of convictism and we breathe a sigh of relief and say, well, thank God that bit's over.
Tom, the Manly Writers Festival wants this to become a platform for grappling with big questions. So as a historian and a novelist, and I guess a lifelong observer of human folly, you know, what are some of the questions that feel the most urgent to you right now? Or I wonder, is that potential folly in itself?
there are some political questions arising from this attempt by the Labour Party to immortalise itself by becoming dead centre of Australian politics. It's not going to work. It's like asking you to make sure you don't earn any more money than the average income. The idea of the true Australians, 40,000 years ago, there were humans living a good life in the Willandra Lakes of New South Wales during the last ice age. That is phenomenal, mind-blowing stuff. And I hope that mind-blowing stuff will be uttered in this oration because people love that. People love getting a new lens to see old questions through.
This is an oration we're talking about, not a eulogy, Tom. It's important to remind people that you are still very busy creating, collaborating. Baz Luhrmann's bringing Joan of Arc to the big screen, drawing on your novel Blood Red, Sister Rose as an inspiration. I mean, how does it feel for you to see that character interpreted through a contemporary lens? And I guess what are you hoping Baz might do with it?
Well, he's come here to talk about it occasionally. There's even a small wine stain on my office floor, which is called the Baz Luhrmann Red Wine Stain.
Good trouble.
And we might open it as a place of pilgrimage. we're hoping to look at this phenomenon of the young woman prophet. And we have an example of one now, Greta Thunberg. And what's noticeable is that as a young prophet, she is much hated. People don't just dislike her, people hate her. And it was so with Joan of Arc too. The question of Joan of Arc's sanity, even of Joan of Arc's muscularity, is an important question to revisit.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour with me, Kylie Morris, and my guest is Thomas Keneally. On the launch of a new oration at the Manly Writers Festival, named in his honour, we're also talking about a bit of Good Trouble, the dead centre, and some mind-blowing stuff. Tom, one issue you've been outspoken about is the rise of AI, especially when it comes to the intellectual property rights of writers. Has there been a personal toll in this fight for you?
I have 79 editions of work being taken by AI, and there are now court cases in America that have been settled in favour of copyright. And so it looks now as if AI will settle with the owners of intellectual property, of books and so on. And that's what there should have been all along. The rest of us don't know to what extent AI will finish fiction or affect the book. But I've been attending seminars about the death of the book since the 60s, and the book refuses to die. And, of course, it has taken on many new forms, including the electronic book and the audio book. And so there will be novelists into the future. We're not trying to hold up artificial intelligence, but at the beginning, everyone was saying, writers should just lie down, let us have the copyright in their work. And that's what brought our rebellion and our series of giving evidence to the Senate committee on this matter. The Senate committee was very much on our side, I'm happy to say. And so we're hoping that whatever happens in the future, it will be as a result of settlement with copyright holders.
Tom, I heard a conversation about music and AI the other day. In fact, it was on Life Matters. And when one of the guests told a story about a friend of his who deleted his music app, the way that he listened to music, because the algorithm kept serving up the same kind of music because it knew that that was what he liked. And he found that really boring or even restrictive. And I wonder, are you worried about curating our tastes so closely that there isn't room for experimentation? Because I was thinking, you know, if you're a Thomas Keneally Schindler's List fan, according to some algorithms or formulas, you might never get to read The Chant of Jimmy Blacksmith because the algorithm wouldn't suggest it to you?
That's probably the truth. But I'm hoping that AI will be formulaic enough to allow individualists still to strut their stuff on the edges. So I'm hoping we'll still exist on the sides of the artificial intelligence mountain. There'll still be little huts where you can buy a fair dinkum novel.
You're listening to the Radio National Hour, and I'm speaking with Australian writer and national treasure, Thomas Keneally. Tom, you recently wrote an op-ed in the Sydney Morning Herald titled, "Call This a Geriatric Rant If You Wish, But at 90, I've Decided Enough is Enough." So what have you had enough of?
Look, you know I'm a Republican, don't you? And
I had heard, yes.
I'm also an admirer of the present King and Queen. It is possible to be both. I mean, what I like about them is the fact they come across as humans. I think the King's mother was such a model of duty and of persevering through all indignities that she became a little inhuman to us. What I think, though, is grotesque is that the King is still head of state of Australia, and yet he can't speak for Australia in international forums because he has to speak for Britain. This is one of the futures I can see for the monarchy. The Tories in England get sick of him being a left-winger, and they take his license away, and he comes to Australia. And so Australia remains a monarchy long after Britain has. We're big people now, and we ought to have a head of state of our own.
Tom, you write about wanting all Australian children, Palestinian, Jewish, Indigenous, immigrant, to grow up free from fear. At 90, I wonder, what fears do you still carry for Australia's future?
Well, I carry the fear of political division that is on a knife edge and can easily turn towards violence. You know, we talk about the offensiveness of neo-Nazism to people of Jewish descent, and I don't think they're very keen on Palestinians either. And I think fascism is a great problem because it involves the possibility of violence. I think in Australia, it's sad to think that Jewish kids have grown up having to ask their mother, "Why don't people like us?" And Palestinian kids have the same problem. And I don't think it should happen in Australia. I think everyone should be on an equal footing. Now, I had to ask my mother this when I was a kid because the Irish in the old days were looked upon as deadbeats. My father, when he enlisted in World War II, said, "I want to show them that Irish Catholics are as good as the others." You know, I don't think we should have to have these tests anymore. If we all commit to being here and being tolerant of each other and living in a society where we sort out things by debate and urbanity, as we are coming to do to this point, then we shouldn't have to ask that. Now, of course, the most tragic thing is an Aboriginal child having to ask its parents, "Why is this thing about us?" Well, the thing about us, it's changing. Most Australians are in favour of a fraternal relationship with the ancient inhabitants of Australia. And the question the Aboriginal kid should be asking, "Aren't we the oldest Australians? Aren't we the truest Australians? Aren't we the Australians the other crowd have to come make an effort to come to terms with?" And the answer to those three questions is yes. So we're on the edge of a number of big disputes in this country, and something fruitful can be said about all of them. When I was a little kid, by the way, I can remember when Greece and Crete fell in 1941. I was a charming 6.5-year-old at that stage. In every block in Sydney, it seemed, on every corner, there were people whose children, whose parents, whose husbands had been taken prisoner with the fall of Greece. And this is the work of Hitlerian Nazi types We don't want that sort of world. But I fear that if Albo lives in the centre and doesn't make it a lot easier for people to have a home, then, you know, we're in great danger from radicals. And I find that in the old days, when everyone had their own home and their own job, there wasn't time to be a dangerous revolutionary. And I'm hoping that if Albo can just dedicate himself to housing and make sure everyone has it, I mean, immediately you kind of claimed by your house, you are a property owner, you sit at the table of the Commonwealth of Australia. And that stops you going around the suburbs attacking other people.
Thomas, thanks so much for your stories and your insights and your time this evening.
Oh, not at all. It's a great pleasure to talk to you, Kylie.
And Thomas Keneally will give the inaugural Thomas Keneally Oration at the Manly Writers Festival in March. And that's it from me for today. Fran will be back with you tomorrow when she'll be joined by the artistic director of the Brandenburg Orchestra and a few of its musicians as they ramp up for the season of Noel. I hope you can join us then. Have a lovely evening.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.